This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Robert Burderi about the new book, Where Futures Converge, Kendall Square and the Making of the Global Innovation Hub. The evolution of the most innovative square mile on the planet. The endless cycles of change and reinvention and that created today's Kendall Square. Burderi, who himself has worked in Kendall Square for the past 20 years, tells fascinating stories of great innovators and their innovations that stretch back two centuries. Well, Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how are you? How has your week been?
It has been great, although we're cold up here in New Hampshire. I'm tired of the cold.
Oh boy. So no sort of walks outside for a very long time now.
Well, I've been doing walks outside, but you know, all bundled up. And I'm just looking forward to the day when you could go out in your shorts and t-shirt, but that's what makes summer so enjoyable. It's because it's so different.
Yeah, for sure. So can you tell us, what do you do?
Well, I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. I guess I'm an entrepreneur too, because I founded my own media company. But these days I'm really just a writer.
And how did you get interested in journalism?
That's a good question. I was always interested. I wrote for my high school newspaper. I wrote for my college newspaper. I just liked telling stories and diving in and maybe unraveling complicated things and making them as simple as possible. I went to graduate school in journalism, and I've spent my whole career in journalism.
And alongside your sort of journey in the journalism realm, so did you have any really supportive colleagues and mentors?
Not a single person helped me. I know, just kidding. all along the way, there are key people who help you out. And it could just be with one particular thing, you know, one little problem or one instance that just made something more real, or you know, a light bulb went off, those kinds of things. And for me, I thought I'd be, you know, more of a general. I started out as a newspaper reporter, but just by a quirk of fate, I became more of a magazine person. And then I got into this whole intersection of science, technology, and business. And that's where I spent a lot of my career. And those are, you know, key people, but also key events that happen during your career.
And how
did the journalism sort of change over time? Did you notice very big changes in it?
I mean, huge changes, especially in what we call journalism, because when I started in journalism and when I went to graduate school, there were the little things called truth and verifying your sources that were just drummed into you, checking things, getting two confirmations of every controversial item you would write. Those things are just gone now. Furthermore, you know, a reporter was really secondary to the story and was not about building their own brand or anything the way it is now. You know, there was no social media. All those things have changed what journalism is in our society. And some things maybe for the better, but a lot not for the better.
What would you say to our younger listeners and maybe early career researchers and students who might consider a career in journalism?
Well, in journalism and science, I mean, it's a much needed thing in society and professions, for sure. It can be very tough and challenging. I feel like it's the professional, educated version of owning a restaurant or something, where it's really tough to make your way sometimes. But it's, you know, it's like many things. If you're following your passion, you'll often do well, and it brings you a lot of joy and, you know, a decent living and those kinds of things. So if that's where your passion is, I would say definitely follow it, try to find key people and advisors who can help you navigate what's often a tough road.
So your latest book is Where Futures Converge, Kendall Square and the Making of a Global Innovation Hub. So can you tell us, how did you come to writing it?
Well, a lot of this comes back to very, you know, specific events that go way back. When I was a reporter in the Time Magazine Bureau in San Francisco in the 1980s, I got a fellowship to MIT for writers who write about science and technology. And that's when I came east and discovered Kendall Square, which is this very unique, very small, not even 1 square mile next to MIT, that's known as one of the world's greatest innovation hubs and the world's most dense great innovation hub. And when I came, I didn't know really anything about it when I came, and yet in 1986, but yet pretty much I've spent with a few years of exception, I've spent the rest of my career right in and around Kendall Square. This fascinating convergence of innovation, science, technology, business, that is addressing some of the world's, you know, big challenges in health and energy and beyond. So it was just a natural, although very long, route to telling this story.
So what was your role there? Were you like a passive observer, or were you also contributing?
Well, I guess I was both. I worked in the square first as a fellow right next to the square at MIT. Then I had a job in a technology review magazine, which was based in Kendall Square. So I'm passive observer, but observer. I founded my own company, a media company called Xconomy. We founded it specifically in Kendall Square to be part of that ecosystem. And that what we were writing about was the business of science and technology. And we felt there was no better place in the world to be than right there in the heart of it. So in that case, we're a participant as well.
So you bring this really unique perspective in your book of a real insider to the Kendall Square. So let's delve into some of the topics that you cover. And let's start with, what exactly is Kendall Square? How do we understand it?
Well, it is this very small piece of land. I would say, you know, maybe 10 blocks by 10 blocks, or maybe a little bit bigger than that, about a half square mile of real estate that is right next to MIT. It's a place where it's become this innovation hub where you're mixing entrepreneurs, students, big companies, startups in biotechnology and energy and computing and artificial intelligence, all these different fields. And what I have always been so excited about is not, you know, what one field is doing, like biology or computing, but what's happening when those two fields come together and the convergence of those fields. And that is where some of the most interesting and important innovations arise from. And so that's what Kendall Square is. It's this very concentrated piece. It's like if you took Silicon Valley, which is much bigger in total mass and so forth, and you boiled it down to less than one square mile. That's what Kendall Square is.
Interesting. So basically, it's not really unique in its idea, but it really has something that makes it unique in the sense. So what would be its significance?
Well, so I think that concentration is what's unique and what's, you know, I've been to innovation areas all over the world, and I know people come to study Kendall Square from all over the world. There's nothing as compact and dense as Kendall Square. And what makes it so, I think, special besides that is that because of that compactness, you're often just walking down the street or having a coffee and you're running into amazing people. Some are, you know, Nobel laureates, famous inventors, and then others are students, or they're a startup entrepreneur and they have an idea, and it just makes it so easy to bounce ideas, to find new partners, to find new colleagues, all those things that that drive innovation. And so that's kind of what makes it most unique.
And how did it all begin?
Well, it began as off almost not, I wouldn't say by accident, but it became this natural place between in the way back, we're talking way back in the 1600s and 1700s. Harvard had been established and Cambridge had been established in the early 1600s, maybe 1630. Boston, of course, was already established, and there was nothing really in between Boston and Harvard Square and Harvard. And it was actually very hard to get between the two. And Kendall Square is that midpoint. Or it's that intersection, it's that bridge. It's right across the river from Boston. It's the fastest way to get to Harvard if you could get over that piece of the Charles River and then go straight down the coast. You'd be right in Harvard Square, and so it became this natural place for people to first build the bridge and then to kind of set up the little infrastructure, the businesses, the shipping areas, the transportation centers, those kind of things that connected people. It was this natural connection point. And I think that's what made it, that's what gave it its leg up on so many other areas. It was this natural intersection, this crossroads for people and businesses to come together.
So was it a case that this place really attracted these kinds of people who were sort of entrepreneurial spirit people, or did it make them once they were already there?
I think it's both. It's this very weird mashup of things. You know, it was this natural place for, if you wanted to be close to Boston, which was a center of commerce, there's lots of money, those kind of things, or workforce, but you wanted cheap land to build your company or to put a laboratory or something like that, that was Kendall Square. So everybody thinks it became this innovation hub because of MIT, but actually MIT didn't get there until 1916. And it was already an innovation hub long before MIT arrived because of this crossroads location that it attracted people. It was a cheap place to build companies, but yet have access to a workforce. But two, it begat other things. So once you're in that environment, you know, you might be an engineer at an early company, but then you see other people like you and you get your own idea. And so it kind of feeds back and you start your own business, feeds back on itself. And so it became, you know, kind of both a place to attract entrepreneurs, but also a place that spawned new entrepreneurs.
So what were some of those early companies that got rise in that space?
The first, what I would say, world-changing set of innovation that came out of Kendall Square was a railroad car innovator, a young guy named Charles Davenport, who came up with very key innovations in just how to make railroad cars work better. Make them quieter, make them less, bouncy and jostly. He did things like put a center aisle down the middle of a railroad car so that people could easily access both sides of it. He put different doors in different locations to make it easier access. All these things that we think of are so standard, he innovated in the 1830s, 40s, and he became this huge worldwide employer and maker of railroad cars, and he ended up buying up a lot of the land around Kendall Square as well. So that was one of the very first. Not too long after him, there was a company called Boston Woven Hose, which invented a way to make rubber hoses strengthen them by weaving them together in certain ways, and they became the basis for fire hoses that you see all over the world. And they also innovated in bicycle tires. And they, at one point, were, you know, just a world-leading company in the late 1800s and early 1900s. There were rubber companies, was something like 10% of all rubber in the United States was being built in Kendall Square. There were just these amazing innovations and leading companies, and that's all by 1900. So after that, after that came Polaroid, another world-changing. Company that was just based in Kendall Square. The private lab of the founder Edwin Land was right in Kendall Square. That's where black and white photography was advanced, instant color film, all those things, and you thought it would never end. More recently we have companies like Lotus 1-2-3 and, you know, the world leading software spreadsheet maker, actually bigger than Microsoft in the early 1990s. And you thought all these things would continue forever. They're pretty much all gone now. And now we have this new era where Kendall Square is the I don't think it's much of a dispute that it's the biotech capital of the world, but I think one thing you have to ask in light of history is how long will that continue, and you know, can it continue forever? Well, it's a good question.
So how has this space evolved over time? So was there something centralized, or was it really organic the way sort of everything was structured?
It's again, I think when you look at innovation zones and how they arise and things like that, I mean, some are very engineered, especially in, you know, new places like in the States. Something like Research Triangle Park was a very well thought out plan. Kendall Square was not like that. It was this mishmash or mashup of some things were very well thought up and planned, and other things were just completely organic, fluky. It was that convergence, I think, that gave it a lot of its soul, because it does not, especially traditionally, feel like this, you know, high-end professional place where all these successful businesses are. It traditionally, and maybe it's changing now, recently, in recent years, but it's a place where startups and really, just people hanging on to their idea, barely making ends meet kind of things. Until the 2000s, there were many undeveloped areas and dirt parking lots and old garages and stuff like that, where you could still find people starting their companies and so forth. And so it had this kind of organic, messy feel that begets a lot of innovation. And it's only in recent years that's changed, that things have just gotten so expensive. It's very hard for the startups, especially, to make their way in Kendall Square anymore.
So can you give us a few examples of the companies that are inhabiting this place now?
Sure. I mean, you look in the biotech world and the kind of pioneering biotech company on the eastern United States was Biogen, and it's still there. It's still headquartered right in Kendall Square, right where it actually got founded in Europe, but it moved very early in its career to Kendall Square to be near two of its key founders, one from MIT and one from Harvard, and it stayed there ever since it just had its 40th anniversary. So it's been there an awful long time. More recently, only about 10 years old, founded and spent its whole life in Kendall Square, is Moderna, the maker of one of the key vaccines for COVID. It's right in Kendall Square. And so these are homegrown companies that started here and grew to become world leaders. But at the same time, you have other leading, especially pharmaceutical companies, that have moved major operations, including a worldwide headquarters for R&D, say, like Novartis, into Kendall Square. Pretty much, I would say it's something like 15 out of 20 of the largest pharmaceutical makers in the world have pretty established major scientific centers in Kendall Square now. So you name them, you know, Takeda, Bristol Myers Squibb, Merck, you know, just keep naming Johnson & Johnson. It just goes on and on. And that's just the biotech side. What's happening also on the kind of more information technology side is there are major labs for pretty much all the world leading competing companies: Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple. They're all Facebook, now called Meta. They're all in Kendall Square as well.
So as we spoke about the companies, so let's think about more on the individual level. So what kind of individuals really emerged from this ecosystem?
You know, it's this mix of one of the key things when you have an entrepreneurial ecosystem that's successful, you have these, of course, entrepreneurs and people who are always thinking about building companies or pursuing their ideas. But around them, you have all these other highly talented people that might just be great chemists or great biologists or great engineers or great computer scientists. So you have that mix as well. And then you have this ecosystem around them that are the lawyers, the communications people, the accountants, the real estate people, and then the managers, the management expertise. So it's basically that whole range of people who are interested in the business of anything that's scientific or technologic. You have students, you have, you know, veterans, you have, you know, people who want to be entrepreneurs, but you have others who just want to do their pursue their profession with the resources, you know, that are necessary to do it. So it's everybody.
With regards to culture, so what kind of people are there, you know, on a daily basis?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a highly educated, people might say, you know, nerds and geeks to some degree, but it's not like that really. I think here's what I would say about the culture, because I've only lived in big cities like New York, San Francisco, Boston areas. They're all kind of hubs. And I've spent my career in this kind of area of science and technology. But what's different, what I would say is different about the culture inside that concentration of people interested in science and technology is a very, it's far less money oriented than it is problem oriented. And you almost, to some degree, it's the opposite of Silicon Valley. You see people not thinking, how do I make money, but how do I solve an important problem? And I'm not saying that isn't happening in Silicon Valley either. There's plenty of people doing that. It's just that the ethos, the culture, that's what really jumps out at you in Kendall Square that's different, I think. It's about the problem and not what, you know, the people can get out of it so much.
Interesting. And on another note then, what about diversity? So how welcome are like minorities and female inventors?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a unique challenge to Kendall Square. It's certainly one Kendall Square faces. One of the things I write about in the book, I have a chapter called 40 Missing Companies, and it's about these three women professors at MIT, Sangeeta Bhatia, Susan Hockfield, who's the former president of MIT, and Nancy Hopkins, who's a professor emerita at MIT. And they started a group called the Future Founders Initiative. And basically it came upon the realization that when you looked at the data, and they did a deep dive into the data, and I'm part of the volunteer group that works with them, they found that women faculty at MIT, and this is just at MIT, were founding companies at a much lower rate than their male counterparts. And there are lots of reasons for this, but they found, bottom line is, if women faculty founded companies at the same rate as their male counterparts, there would be 40 more companies in the Boston area than currently exist. And that's why it's called 40 Missing Companies. And this whole initiative, which is now more than 2 years old, it's done a lot of really important things. And it's not just women making this up. It's about 30 key people, and men and women, who feel this is a big problem. Basically try to address that issue. And it's not just discrimination. And I don't even think it's very much discrimination, because people in Kendall Square are very open to women entrepreneurs. But there's a hidden kind of discrimination, but there's also just the whole system by which you become an entrepreneur has just not been as accessible to women. And women faculty, even highly successful women faculty, they don't feel as comfortable in business. They're not included in business discussions as much, and it kind of feeds a big feedback loop. So the idea of the Future Founders Initiative was really to break that. So how do you get women faculty more familiar with business? How do you give them, how you get over that hump, so to speak? And so it's addressing a lot of issues, like just venture capital firms that invite women to be on their scientific advisory board of the company they're founding, say, so that the women become familiar with business practices, then they're much more comfortable and able to come up with their own idea. If they have an idea to start their own company, well, if they've had exposure to how startups work, of course they have a much bigger chance of success of starting their own company. Those kind of things. So there's those have been going on. They've created a new paid fellowships for women faculty to go into venture firms and work there, with their salaries being paid by the venture firms for kind of like a sabbatical, so they can become familiar with business practices, build the connections that they need for their own company ideas, those kinds of things. There's a new prize competition that just will start this year for women faculty at MIT with a $250,000 prize. And there's a series of boot camps that have been put on by men and women to help women faculty learn what is involved in starting a company, and how you get financing for it, how you build the team that you need, those kinds of things. And so it's just been a broad addressing of the challenges that women face in becoming entrepreneurs. And I think that's going to make, it's the kind of thing that takes years to really pay off, but it's made tremendous progress in the last few years. And I think we're going to be seeing some real fruits of that. So sorry for that. It's a little bit of a long-winded answer, I know, but it's a big problem. And then, of course, now you have people of color have the same issues, but they're different too. So it's not exactly the same. So you can't just do a cookie cutter solution. And so what the Future Founders Initiative is doing is they're focused on women, but they're trying to make sure that this involves a lot of women of color to help them as well. And then they're hoping it points the way to addressing the broader challenge with minorities on getting access to entrepreneurship and resources and so forth. But it's not doing that directly at this point.
Oh, it's really great that you are addressing these topics. So important.
It's just critical. And I think, I give Sangeeta Bhatia, Susan Hockfield, and Nancy Hopkins just so much credit, because they built this coalition that really makes a difference. And it's not like, it's just very cooperative and collegial. It's not saying, hey, you've been bad for not including women. It's not blaming people. It's just saying, we've got challenges in society that we have to address, and let's do this. And that's why you've seen just this tremendous outpouring of men and women working to address this issue.
Exactly. So constructive approach rather than blaming game.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not in anger. It's almost in joy. I wouldn't say joy per se, but it's in this great spirit of camaraderie that I think people are just warming to, and it's making a real difference, I believe.
So you've spoken about quite a few positive sides of Kendall Square. So what would be some main criticisms?
Well, I think you still have to say, it's not as open to women and people of color as it should be. And those are ongoing challenges for all of society in many fields. But if you step away from the people side, there's the transportation issue. And that's been a pretty big mess for quite a while. Is just the subway line that gets in there, that goes into Kendall Square, is the main one, called the Red Line, is beset with aging infrastructure, delays, and so forth. The roads are just crowded. It's very difficult to find a place to park if you were driving in there. All those kinds of things. I think it's not unique to Kendall Square, but it's a challenge. And then the last, I guess that I would put in the big societal type of challenge that faces Kendall Square is just the housing. I mean, it is a sterile area compared to many places. It's really 90-something% about business, and it does not have much of a feel for a neighborhood. There are very few, relatively speaking, places to live right there. And they tend to be high-end condos and luxury apartments that, if you're making $200,000 a year, working in a biotech company, that's great. But it's not affordable for a lot of families and a lot of younger people and the communities that really make up vibrant ecosystems. So I think those things remain challenges. As something I mentioned before, just on the startup side, it's very hard now for a startup to afford to be in Kendall Square. And that, to the extent startups aren't in there, that's a piece of its kind of history and soul that's missing. And so things are being done on all these fronts to address these problems, and I write about those as well. But they're all, there's no overnight fix for any of these things.
So where do you see Kendall Square going next?
I really have been struck in writing this book. It didn't take me long as I started telling the story. And I try to write this book in a narrative storytelling way, very extensively researched, but told through the eyes of the people and the companies in a narrative way, and that I hope makes it accessible. But one of the things that just jumped out at me so early on is what we talked about briefly earlier, is that nothing lasts forever. So we think biotech is going to stay dominant forever. I would bet you it won't. Now it's hard to imagine how could that possibly be? Biology, molecular biology, the things that bring us COVID vaccines that address other diseases. How can that not be forever part of human society? Well, it certainly will be. Biology obviously will be part of humankind forever, but will it be biotech? And that's what I question. Or will the nature of biotech change in some way that we can't fully perceive, for instance? But I can start to see, as I talk to people, they can see, and I'm just kind of translating their thoughts and adding a few maybe insights of my own, is that you can see the day when a laboratory, so much of Kendall Square are these big labs now, when a laboratory won't be necessary the way we think of laboratories today, where instead of creating, you know, a biological organism or doing something like that, you're just coding. Your code, it can be done by computer. You could code a new organism, and you may not need anything more than a computer terminal, really, to do that. And the manufacturing can be moved far away to cheaper places, you know, as manufacturing has always done. You know, when industries grow, they move their manufacturing out to more affordable places. Well, you could see that starting to happen in biology. That makes the future of Kendall Square Biotech different. Or maybe there's a new backlash against drug prices that changes the business model for all these companies, and they have to find new ways to do things. You can see all those things happening. So I think the future will include some answers to those questions, and I don't know what they are yet. But then there's new things, new convergences coming together too. So, boy, and you see it in Kendall Square, because you can literally walk across the street and get from a computing company to a major biotech or biology company, and all of them, whether they're computing companies, they have healthcare arms, and if they're biology companies, they have computing arms, and those fields are coming together at this rapid rate, and things like AI and AI and healthcare and so forth. So you can really see that some new type of futures coming out of convergence of computing and biology, trends that have already been well, you know, underway, just reaching some new level that we can't quite imagine yet. So anyway, those were just a few of my thoughts on that front.
Do you think work from home will also contribute to easing those pressures on housing and transportation?
Certainly on transportation, I think, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, a lot of my writing was done during the pandemic, I think it will be closer to the old way in 2 years than people think, myself. I think the pressures to get back in the office, the incentive to be around your colleagues and the people that are often the sources of new ideas will be just innate in people. And so I think the ease on all those things won't last that long. I think in a very few years, we're going to be back to having the transportation and housing crunches that we had before.
So perhaps this face-to-face and close collaborations is something that's really fostering this kind of innovation.
Absolutely. And so, maybe you don't go in every day like you did before. I mean, but you still want that. And a lot of people want that. So I think it is going to, you know, we're going to get back to it. Oh, one of the people at the Broad Institute, which is a major research center right in Kendall Square, a nonprofit, said to me, which I thought was very interesting, you know, so much of the advances to address COVID, whether not just on vaccines, but some of the other treatments and so forth, came through from these worldwide collaborations of people who were far flung, who weren't even going into their labs, who were at their homes because, you know, we're all connected with the internet and so forth. But he said, but you know what? They were able to do that collaboration because they knew each other from the past, because they'd gone to school together, they'd been working, they'd been colleagues together. And it was the very, we realized the fruits of having people work together, up close and personal in addressing the pandemic from afar. And if we lose those tight connections that make you trust people on the other side of the planet to work with you on a project, well, you know, something else will be lost in innovation in the future. the next time we have some big problem. And so I think people want to be back building those ties, building those networks that enable them to be successful when they're apart as well.
That is such a crucial insight into fruitful collaboration, especially that you mentioned trust that you have to build.
Yes, yes.
So now thinking about the bigger picture, what would be the key implications of having such innovation fostering hubs for our society? And can Kendall Square be taken as an example of how we should construct these places?
You know, another thing that I learned, I went to some history of business conference, I don't know, 2 decades ago, and there was a professor there who talked about one of the keys to success. You know, America, for a long time, people have come from all over the world to be more innovative like America. You know, you saw this in Asian societies that would send people to America to learn to think more creatively, to be more American in that sense. And places like Kendall Square were getting tours, economic development tours from groups all over the world trying to emulate, learn the secrets of Kendall Square. They would come almost weekly to try to glean some things that they could take back to build their own. One of this key insight that I got several decades ago was, it's not just that you do this thing, this one thing. It's so much innovation comes from what this guy called, I forget his name, he was at Johns Hopkins University, he called competing centers of excellence. And you need more than one. So the fact that Kendall Square benefits from both Harvard and MIT, as well as other great universities in the Boston area, like Tufts or Boston University, that those competing centers of excellence feed into these ecosystems. So you need more than one. You can't just have your country's ecosystem. You need to somehow foster different arms or different types of ecosystems, whether it's in a country or a region, those kinds of things. So it's a tough one. And then so much of Kendall Square is just by accident, and then other parts have been planned. Can you do it if you just plan it? I don't know the answer, but I do know that if you don't try, you won't succeed. So I have some ideas on that front, but you know, they're still forming in a lot of ways.
And what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, Where Futures Converge, surprised you the most?
Well, I think this idea that I mentioned before, that Kendall Square was an innovation hub before MIT. But here's another one that, you know, if you look at what Kendall Square is now and this biotech hub and this computer science hub that it is, that's certainly hugely influenced by MIT's presence, right? I mean, you literally walk across the street from MIT and you're in Kendall Square with, you know, startups and big companies. I mean, it's like an amazing place in that regard. But it took MIT, as I mentioned, was moved to Kendall Square in 1916. It really was, depending on how you count, 40 or 50 years before it really made a huge impact on Kendall Square. So you don't get these things overnight just because you have a great university or something like that. You have to have, in one way or another, you have to have a true commitment over the long term. And that's very hard. You know, you have governments, you have policymakers, these things, they come up with an idea for now, but then what happens, you know, when they hit their first recession or something like that? They abandon their plan, they shift their plan. Well, you can't really do that. You have to be there for the long haul, and that's very tough for places to do. That was a big, you know, kind of not surprising in a way, but it was still an eye-opener for me.
And whilst you were working and living there, were there any places that you really liked, like coffee shops? And did you have trees? Can you just sit on a bench, for example?
Oh, it wasn't until, like, I would say 2012, something like that, that it got like a little park right in Kendall Square, and with an ice skating rink for the winter. And then they would, in the summer, it would be, you know, a little kind of half shell for bands to play and people to get in, very small. That kind of green space walk around, it's a big part of future development plans, and there's more of it. But it's always been lacking. But sure, I mean, I had my favorite spot, but it wasn't, it literally wasn't until like 2010 or later that you started getting, that you had, you know, more than a handful of restaurants and bars to go to. There's no nightclub, you know, but there are some, a lot of the restaurants unfortunately went out of business during COVID, and they haven't come back yet, or new places in those spaces. A few are, you know, it's better than it was, but it's still got a long way just to get back to where it was, which wasn't much of anything. I mean, when you would walk around Kendall Square after work, you probably had 15, you know, restaurants and bars you could go to with your colleagues, have a drink. Those kind of places were great. But after like 9 o'clock, it was dead, and it was dead on the weekends. So I think that still remains a problem. But sure, I had my favorite places. And one thing is you could easily just walk and meet people for that lunch, for that, you know, beer after work, that kind of thing.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. So can you tell us, what are you currently working on, and what will be your next project?
I can't tell you for sure. I mean, Where Futures Converge is my fifth book. And I love writing books, but I also love interacting with people. So I think I will continue to help with the Future Founders Initiative to the extent that I can, to help you know, open doors in whatever little way I can contribute for women faculty and so forth. I'm going to try my first fiction writing, and then I'm gonna take a little time. I have my basketball team is getting up for a major tournament in May, so I'm training for that, and then we'll see after the summer where I go as far as work.
What would be the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, if they just Google Where Futures Converge, that'll lead them to the MIT Press site for my book right away. I think that's the best place, and it has some of the, you know, a description of the book and some of the people who've read it and, you know, said nice things about it, that kind of thing. And other than that, I keep a very low profile these days. I am off of all social media, and you know, if they have questions for me, the best is to, you know, write into MIT Press. You know, I don't have a personal website up or anything like that.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, pleasure for me. Thank you for having me.